From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
A new book came my way recently with a title that just said it all. Lawns into Meadows is what it's called, and its author, Owen Wormser, is our guest today. More on meadow making in a minute, but first, these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full-gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
Landscape designer Owen Wormser's new book is called Lawns into Meadows, Growing a Regenerative Landscape, and his approach is just that. Owen owns Abound Design, a firm based in Western Massachusetts that emphasizes sustainability, regeneration, and beauty, he says. And I'm so glad to welcome him to the program today to talk about making meadows. Hi, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm so glad to get the book. And before we start, I should say that we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show on awaytogarden.com. So people would be able to enter to win it. So they'll get that just said. And so to start, the book begins by making the case for meadows versus lawns, which I've talked about on the show various times with other guests, Doug Tallamy and so forth. But give us sort of the scene setting quick pitch on why meadows versus lawns before we dig into your really accessible how-to. Especially your sort of how meadows store carbon argument.
Yeah, so a lot of people know about how lawns are biological deserts and they cause a lot of environmental problems. That's something that you've covered in the past. And meadows are really the opposite of that, and that they create this level of abundance. And one of the ways in which they do that is that they actually build soil, including sequestering large amounts of carbon. So meadows are incredibly effective at drawing in carbon dioxide, like all plants, breaking that down, releasing the oxygen, taking that carbon, and storing it in the ground. And unlike trees, which put a lot of carbon in their trunks, which eventually some of that is, or most of that's released back into the atmosphere, meadow plants really park their carbon in the soil, and their roots can extend as far as 10 or 15 feet into the ground. So they're really sort of carbon sequestering machines. And this is a way that you can sequester carbon in your yard, and instead of contributing to global warming with mowing your lawn and using fossil fuels, you can have a meadow and sink carbon right in your own, on your own property.
Sounds like a very good thing to be doing at the moment. definitely. But I hadn't really read so much about that part of the argument. You know, I'd read about the lack of diversity, the monoculture, the fact that we mow the lawn into submission so it doesn't even produce flowers or seeds for insect benefit, blah, blah, blah. So that was a really good point. Now, you talk about meadows and meadow gardens, and you differentiate between the two. Explain what the two are.
The differentiation that I make in the book is that meadows are planted from seed and meadow gardens are planted using live plants that are usually called plugs. They're basically baby plants that come in a tray. So they're still native perennials, native meadow perennials, but they are planted into the ground and they establish faster than a meadow from seed. However, because you're planting live plants, usually they're only, meadow gardens are only effective for smaller areas, and meadows from seed are generally a much more reasonable way to plant larger areas.
Ah, okay. Okay. When you go to see a prospective new client, are a lot of them home landscape type of people, small to medium sized potential meadows that are sort of more meadow gardens, or?
It's both.
It's both.
But I do deal with a lot of residential clients, and an area that's sort of maybe a quarter acre or smaller potentially could be considered, but really small spaces are the best for meadow gardens. So spaces that are sort of courtyards or garden size areas. And those areas can be cleared and prepped like you were planting a meadow from seed, which we'll get into a little bit. But basically, you're just planting into a cleared area with live plants, spacing them, depending on the species, 12 to 18 inches apart. And then they fill in really quickly, including the grasses, and they give you the effect of a meadow, even if it's in a smaller space.
Mm. So you say in the book, designing a successful meadow is mostly about choosing grasses and flowers that will be happy where you plant them. So what makes them happy? What are some of the key things that you really evaluate and consider depending on where you're working?
Yeah, so one of the criteria for building meadows is that they get at least half a day of direct sunlight. And once you determine that an area has that, really, you can almost definitely find plants that will match the site. And that's one of the best things about meadows is that they can grow pretty much anywhere. But what you want to determine is what you're dealing with on that site. What are those conditions? And so soil quality, the type of soil, is it clay? Is it gravel? Is it sandy? Those details have to be figured out. And then the moisture of the soil also has to, the ability for the soil to hold water has to be figured out. Does it dry out very easily? So those are some examples of the factors that need to be considered. And it's terribly important that you understand your site so that you can match the plants to the existing conditions.
Mm. And there are so many different, even in nature, there are technically wet meadows, for example. Ones that's their reality. They're in a place where at least during one season or even longer, it's a moist spot. But those are different plants than grow in a more xeric kind of a meadow. Yes,
absolutely. And so that's what will determine the success of a meadow over time, or its ability to establish even, is whether or not the plants you're using are matched to those conditions.
Right, right. You talked about, you know, prairie roots, you know, the roots or roots of certain of these plants going down 10 or 15 feet. I've seen some of those historic pictures. You know, I'm just thinking of different sites and how the root systems work underground in different conditions. And I've seen some of the historic pictures of sort of slices of the underground, of the soil, looking at the roots of the plants of the prairie in the Midwest and so forth, mm-hmm. done at the University of Wisconsin and their mm-hmm. prairie restoration and stuff. And it's just incredibly fascinating how some of those plants learn to adapt to that site by having these really, really deep root systems,
exactly.
Be resilient to that site.
Absolutely. It's pretty astonishing how much root mass is below ground with certain meadow plants.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. In the book, you say that you always consider which grasses first, before the forbs, before the flowers, you think about which grasses, and that you always include two grasses or up to four in a design. And tell us a little bit about why grasses are your first thought consideration, and also, do you think about height and stuff too? I mean, what are the other things you think about in starting conceiving the design?
Yeah, absolutely. So grasses are what create the character visually that reads like a meadow. Mm. So meadows include grasses, and people expect that visually, but not only is it sort of what a meadow is, they really make a meadow more aesthetic, and they soften the flowers that have gone by, and they fill out the meadow in a way that creates that basically the grasses billowing in the wind look that from meadows. So it's they're very, very important in that regard. And there's two types of grasses, and there's grasses that grow in the spring and the fall primarily, and those are called cool season grasses. And then there's warm season grasses, which like to grow in the summer. And usually I use both. And the warm season grasses are the ones that I focus on the most. And really, in the book, I encourage people to generally focus on those. But usually, I'll also use maybe one cool season grass as well. And, you know, the warm season grasses bunch, so they allow other plants to grow around them without spreading too much. And so they really play nicely with other meadow plants. And when I'm considering grasses and other meadow plants, I am considering height. And I'm also considering with the other meadow plants, like bloom time and their color. And ultimately, I want plants blooming throughout the course of the growing season, not just for aesthetics, but also for food, for pollinators. Right, so right. Height and bloom time are really important factors as well.
Mm. So just tell us a couple of species of warm versus cool, just to give us a visual of, like, I think little blue stem, for instance, is a warm season grower. Is that correct? And it's a bunch grass.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. So little blue stem is one of my favorite warm season grasses. And it's something that I included a lot of times in meadows because it's something that really loves dry conditions. And it's good to kind of hedge your bets when you're choosing meadow plants. So I'm kind of choosing plants that can take a range of conditions. And then if it's a very dry year, some of those plants will have a better year than others. And it all kind of balances itself out over time. And little blue stem is one of those plants that can just take dreadfully dry conditions and is perfectly happy. So I love to use that. It's a beautiful plant. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that a lot of cool season grasses are actually lawn grasses. Cool season grasses right. spread. And they kind of are more mat forming. And that's why I don't use a lot of them. I do focus on the warm season grasses more because, like I said, they're bunching and they don't compete with other plants as much. The spreading grasses, the cool season grasses, are a little bit trickier to use because they can crowd out other plants, including meadow plants. So that's why I often encourage people to start from scratch where they're getting rid of their lawn grass to make it a little easier for other plants to grow. But it's not absolutely required, but it's really helpful to just kind of understand that lawn grasses are cool season grasses.
Okay. So you talked a little bit about seeds versus plugs a few minutes ago, you know, about maybe the scale of the project, and it's sometimes more realistic with a large project that you're going to be using seeds and so forth. But do you sometimes use both? And is there timing differences in when we would, I hate the word install, but you know what I mean? When we would plant this, I just using the word plant when I'm talking about, do I use seeds or plants sounds redundant. just a little more about that seed versus plug stuff.
Yeah. So sometimes I do use them both. Plugs, basically a lot of times they'll give much faster results because they're just going to take off and start growing. So sometimes closer to a house or a prominent location, I'll put in plugs to just kind of give more color in the short term. But generally, it's based on area, and larger areas I'm using seed. So when I'm planting from seed, I'm basically prepping in the same way that I would be planting from plugs as well. So they're interchangeable depending on sort of how quickly you want results, I guess is one way to look at it.
And maybe the budget too, in some cases, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, seed is much more economical and you can cover much larger areas that way.
Yeah.
Compared to live plants.
Yeah. So you just said prep. And so this, of course, is where those of us as home gardeners, or I have a slightly larger site than the average backyard, but nevertheless, I'm a one person show, a home garden. The prep, we all wonder, how the heck do we transform this piece of lawn? You know, it seems daunting. And so tag us a little bit, you know, through that. I mean, let's assume that we're not doing acres and acres. Now, I have to confess that I did the most simple way of all, when I first came to where I am 30 plus years ago, I kind of started unmowing, as I say, certain areas, because I recognized, I knew something about native plants. I recognized little blue stem was present. I knew it was a warm season grower, and people who have listened to the show before have heard me say this. And I knew that I could knock back, if I waited till like around the first week of May to mow where I am, I could knock back the cool season mat forming grasses. And I could favor the little blue stem when it was just beginning to emerge, and I could get more blue stem and less of the other guys in this meadow. It's, you know, that was my method. It's not the best method, but it's pretty. I love it. And the insects love it, and the birds love it. So I don't know so much about the prep at all, and it's always sort of frightened me. You know, looks daunting, but tell me, how do we do it?
So one approach is the approach that you used, that's the easiest thing to do. And ultimately, you can let part of your lawn grow up, and you can also potentially seed into it either by using what's called a drill seeder, which basically scores into your lawn and places seeds into the score marks so that they have soil contact. Or you can even just sprinkle seeds over the lawn, or you can even plant plugs into a lawn. Mow it one last time, plant those plugs, mark where they are, make sure that they don't get overtaken by lawn grass as it grows up, and they'll establish. So that's one way to do it. And that can be effective. It depends sort of on the situation you're dealing with, but it's still going to be far more environmentally friendly than having a lawn, and it's going to still be able to park a lot of carbon in the ground. So that's one way. And really, the other sort of main way of doing this is to strip the grass out and till, or simply till repeatedly and get rid of the grass that way. That's an organic approach to getting rid of what's there, including the seed bank, because if you till repeatedly, that allows you to really get anything, to kill anything that resprouts. So that's important, because what that allows for is for the seed mix or the plugs that are being planted to really be in an environment where there's little or no competition. And so if those plants can establish, then basically they can generally hold their own. And then with very little maintenance, you just have to mow once a year. And that generally does the trick. So that's sort of the long and short of it.
Okay.
But there's nuances, of course, and the book gets into that.
Now, you said till, and is it just a plain old home rototiller, or is there how repeatedly is repeatedly?
Yeah, so tilling has to be effective enough so that the grass and vegetation that's already there is really churned into the soil so that it can be eliminated so it doesn't sprout. So repeatedly depends on how much the vegetation wants to resprout. So usually it's 2 to 4 times. And usually a home rototiller isn't quite strong enough. There's a type of tiller called a hydraulic tiller that's a little bit bigger. And they're generally able, they're still a walk behind, but they're able to chew up the grass pretty effectively. And, you know, this can be really hard work. So sometimes I really encourage people just to hire a local landscape company to come and actually do all the prep work, if that's easier, because a lot of times it is, because it can be very difficult work. But basically, it's a matter of kind of using the Rodell method of organic weed control. Repeated cultivation eliminates the seed bank and everything that resprouts.
Right. And you said something else really important. You said mowing once a year. And that's for people to understand. I mean, a lot of times we think meadow, oh, you never mow it. You know, it's not a lawn. We don't. But you do, because a lot of them, I guess, in nature, they either had fire or, for instance, was one of the methods in certain regions that took down the debris, so to speak, occasionally. You know, otherwise woody plants start to come in and, you know, things can happen that are not as desired. I think the timing of the mowing is really important. Like, I would never mow. It breaks my heart when I see farms near me mow in early fall or mid-fall and not leave all that deliciousness there for the animals to eat all winter, you know, and for important insects and other arthropods to overwinter in underneath the debris and so forth, you know. So I do it after the winter, once everybody's had a chance to wake up after some fair weather in the early spring, but not too early. Yes. If that makes sense. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's really well said, what you just explained. And allowing the plants to overwinter gives the insects that have larvae on there or eggs that allows them to emerge in the spring. But also meadows are really beautiful in the winter, and they also provide a lot of seed for rodents and birds and basically support the food chain. So they do that. But like I said, they're beautiful, and in winter sunlight, especially in the early morning and late evening, a lot of times meadow grasses are pretty stunning. So yes, it's nice if you can leave them there in the winter. And the bit about mowing once a year is critical. And like you alluded to, fire has historically been a huge sort of input for maintaining meadows. And the other one was grazing animals like bison.
Right. I forgot.
And so, but the point being that there has to be something that basically keeps woody plants like trees and shrubs from taking over. And so therefore, if you have a meadow, you want to mow it, you have to mow it once a year, and that cuts back the woody plants and puts them at a disadvantage and allows your meadow to endure.
We have a few minutes left, maybe 3-4 minutes left. And after care tips, I've just sort of brought up one of them, which is that raspberries or blackberries or whatever, something's going to come in that's woody that you don't want. Is there what's Owen's method of dealing with when woodies come in? What do you do besides the ones you're mowing when you still are having the problem, even with that? Do you edit them out? Do you dig them out? Any tricks for that?
Yeah, so digging them out can work, even just cutting them back repeatedly. Yeah. If you have to cut them back once or twice a season and do some real selective cutting, that can work. So even raspberries and blackberries and cane plants like that, as an example of a sort of weedy plant that can be fairly aggressive. Usually if you mow once a year and then if they're a problem in a certain area, you trim them back maybe once or twice, that usually does the trick.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we haven't mentioned too many different plants in the last couple minutes. Just what are some of the ones you couldn't live without? I mean, I know you have a palette of them in one chapter of the book, but a couple that you just want to shout out to us as among your favorite performers.
Yeah, we mentioned little bluestem, which is certainly a favorite grass of mine, but butterfly weed is a plant that I couldn't do without, which is Asclepias tuberosa. It's a type of milkweed. It has these stunning orange flowers, and it's beloved by a lot of different pollinators, but it also supports monarchs, which are, you know, like a lot of insects sort of hanging by a thread in terms of their well-being on this planet. So planting butterfly weeds one way to support them. So that's a plant that I love. And, you know, I use certain plants like echinacea a lot because they perform and they do really well and they can take a range of conditions. So that's another plant that I really love to use, Echinacea purpurea. And I could go on and on in terms of meadow species, but there are certain ones that really just kind of hit all the check boxes. And those are few that are examples of that.
I saw you included one of the pycnanthemums, the mountain mints, and those have sort of come from nowhere to become like an it plant of the moment. Everyone's talking about pycnanthemums, so I was glad to see one there.
Yeah, and you know, they deserve that. And it's kind of funny how plants come and go in terms of popularity. But it's great that it's getting more attention because it's a really rugged native plant that's beloved by pollinators as well. And so it's a really excellent plant to have in your meadow. And these plants are tough and they don't need anything. And that's the beauty of meadows when it comes to a maintenance perspective. And they're completely opposite of lawns in that regard. And something like pycnanthemum is a very easy to take care of plant.
Well, the book is Lawns into Meadows. We've been talking to Owen Wormser. We're going to have a book giveaway, as I said, with the transcript. And I mean, the subhead of the book also says it all, Growing a Regenerative Landscape. So thank you so much for making the time today, Owen. And I look forward to meeting you in real life before too long, if and when the conditions allow again. So thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Margaret. It's been fun talking to you.
Okay.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com. Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
And thanks to all of the rest of you for listening to Now Don't Miss an Episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @AwayToGarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.